Good evening, everybody. Tonight we are back and we are recording from inside a bunker at Guadalcanal. And believe it or not, there was plenty of furniture as long as we were willing to make it out of human bones. And tonight we are going to be doing a very special episode called Holding Out for a Hero.
Millicent Oriana, culture expert. While seeking to unlock the secrets of all fandoms, she is exposed to an overload of every aspect of pop culture. Now, when asked a question about a piece of popular culture, she becomes curious. Now hosting a podcast and joined by amazing guests, she seeks to find answers and find a way to live off her talents and to make a fun podcast. I'm holding out for a hero.
And if you haven't guessed from our title, tonight's episode is going to be about Japanese holdouts. And those that aren't familiar with Japanese holdouts were soldiers that, for various reasons, refused to surrender after the Allied forces had defeated the Empire of Japan in World War II. And without further ado, I'm going to introduce my co-host,
Jacob Urban,
and my producer,
Sophia Baca. Producer of this podcast and host of Breaking Math.
All right. And as we said, we're going to be talking about the Japanese holdouts, the Zanryu Nipponhei, or remaining Japanese soldiers. And first, we're going to talk about Sake Ooba, who was an officer in the Japanese army during World War II. He served in both China and the Pacific Theater. He went by the nickname The Fox.
Ooh.
Yep. I don't know why I did that. Sorry.
You did that because of that annoying song.
Yeah, I know.
That's why you did that. You should be ashamed. Apparently, it was his men would do guerrilla-style raids on American positions, and due to the speed and stealth of these operations, Marines and Saipan started calling him The Fox. So, by September 30th, 1944, the Japanese army had made an official presumption of death for all personnel of unknown status. So, they were all declared KIA.
Ah.
Like, they declared anybody that they couldn't find after that date KIA, which is kind of nuts.
It is. It really is. It's like, bye.
Yeah, and I mean, it's really actually kind of a good strategy, too, though, especially after your country's been, like, destroyed by a war.
Yeah, I mean,
because you don't really have the resources to dedicate to finding them.
Exactly.
And it's pretty easy to go, oops, if they turn out to be alive.
Yeah, but why declare dead? Why couldn't they be declared, like, officially missing or, like, create a new category?
Because then they didn't have to dedicate any resources to them.
If they were missing, they'd still have to look for them.
Yeah, they'd still have to, like, acknowledge that they were missing.
Do what they did in the American West, just offer money prizes for bringing back soldiers alive.
Yeah, or
that sounds like a bad idea. Don't do that.
They could also do what they did in the 60s, or the 70s, where a bunch of right-wing wackos created an insane conspiracy theory that the whatever, like, 300 U.S. soldiers or whatever were all POWs.
Oh, yeah. If you've driven around, you might have seen this flag and not known it.
Yeah, the POW MIA flags. Okay, so those were started by people that basically purported a myth that these 300 soldiers that were either POW or MIA were all POWs.
They said you were killed on that scouting mission.
No, just captured. It's kind of a funny story, really. After 5 years in a secret POW camp, I was sold to China for slave labor. And since 77, I've been making sneakers at gunpoint in a sweatshop in Wuhan.
That's not a funny story.
Well, I guess you had to be there.
But the truth is, I mean, there's like over 1 million Vietnamese and Cambodian and Laotian people that are just missing because of the war that will never be found. They were eaten by tigers. They were vaporized by napalm.
Oh, yeah. What do they call it? The fog of war?
Yeah. Fog of war.
And that's what happened to those 300 missing soldiers.
Yeah. So, I mean, for a long time, people like Ross Perot purported this myth to try to reinvade Vietnam. I mean, that's what Rambo is all about. The sequel to First Blood is he goes back to Vietnam to rescue his buddies. And it's like, you know, there were a bunch of people that wanted to reinvade Vietnam like Rambo.
Well, they got their head out of their ass with the Mujahideen thing.
Well, yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no, you're right. Rambo 3 is about those brave Mujahideen fighters that kept Russia out. And There was never another problem with Afghanistan afterward.
Nope, Afghanistan was perfect afterward.
Once the Mujahideen reformed and became the Taliban government,
nothing bad happened.
Nothing bad ever happened in Afghanistan ever again. That's why we never heard from them ever again.
Yeah, and nobody has ever said a word about Afghanistan since that.
So you have no idea right
oh,
now?
Oh, there's another one. Another plane just hit. Right? Oh, my God. Another plane has just hit. It hit another building. Flew right into the middle of it. Explosion. My God, it's right in the middle of the building.
This one into the East Tower.
Yes. Yes. Right in the middle of the building.
So like I said, they declared all the Japanese personnel that they couldn't find after September 30th, which... You gotta remember, that's like not even 3 months.
Yeah.
It's not even like...
But...
When the war ended, when again?
July 9th?
Yeah, that... I mean, again, Japan, like...
Had more serious things they had to deal with?
They had a lot of problems after the war, like...
Actually, yeah, I can already say, if your country's experiencing nuclear fallout, you get a pass. You get a pass on that. You're allowed to just go, look, we have way more serious things to deal with than looking for a few people.
Well, and I mean, they really didn't even get to that, like, really that quick either.
Yeah.
Like, they were dealing with, like, because there was the firebombs in Tokyo that, like...
Oh, yeah, destroyed Tokyo.
That destroyed Tokyo. But yeah, the entirety of Japan was basically destroyed...
Yeah,
like, so, large chunks of the country were just gone.
Yeah, so they're allowed... They get a pass on not looking for these guys. Well, also, I mean, after what happened with all the soldiers that just got shot by Philippine people, when they were like, those are the guys that led us into the death march. Kill them.
I think shortly after, too, they... it was Nagasaki had, like, a really bad typhoon hit, which, like, destroyed what was the little was left of... what they had rebuilt. A unexpected benefit of the typhoon hitting was that it washed a lot of the radioactive material out into the ocean instead of letting it fester in the city.
Yeah, which probably helped.
It did, because people weren't dying from just being there anymore. Out. Yeah.
Yeah, because there's places like, you know, like the modern Trinity site where it's like, if you want to have kids long term, you probably shouldn't live there in your 20s, but otherwise it's fine.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you can't live at the Trinity site, but
there's
places that are equally radioactive, though.
Oh, yeah, and that's the thing. So it's kind of nice this happened, because we didn't understand radiation back then, really.
No.
So. We were definitely starting, like, people knew what killed Marie Curie at that time.
Yeah.
But people were very blasé with it, you're right.
I was going to say, like...
Like those kits in the 1950s that had a little bit of uranium in them.
Also, yeah. The fact that they would literally test nuclear bombs in the 50s in Nevada... They would test bombs in Nevada,
mm-hmm.
and then people would just sit there in their hotels, and they'd be watching the fall, like the mushroom cloud, and it'd only be like 60 miles away.
Oh, I know. Yeah, they would. I've heard about those. Yeah.
Yeah, like I saw it right before it got demolished. It literally had a hydrogen atom on the front.
Yeah, I wanted to see that hydrogen atom so bad.
Yeah, I saw it as, like, right before it was demolished when I went to Vegas one time, yeah.
Yeah, so speaking of going somewhere and possibly returning or not.
All right, so getting back to the topic. Okay, so like I said, they declared everybody KIA. In reality, Captain Oba had survived the battle and gradually took command over 100 other soldiers. Only 5 men from his original unit had survived the battle, 2 of who died in the following months. Oba and his remaining men then led over 200 Japanese civilians deeper into the jungles to evade capture. He and his men organized the civilians and placed them in mountain caves in the hidden jungle villages. And when the soldiers were not assisting the civilians with survival tasks, Oba and his men continued their battle against the garrison of U.S. Marines. Oba used Mount Tapo Chao as his primary base at 473 meters. The peak offered an unobstructed 360-degree view of the island. Their base camp on the western slope of the mountain, Oba and his men occasionally conducted guerrilla raids, and that's when, like, yeah, the Marines started referring to him as the Fox.
And what year are we in? 1945, right?
No, 44.
44, okay, so he would have been 29.
Yeah. And so September 44, the Marines began conducting patrols on the island's interiors, searching for survivors who were raiding their camp for supplies. And these patrols would encounter Japanese soldiers or civilians, and when they were captured, they would be interrogated and sent to an appropriate prison camp. It was during these interrogations the Marines learned Oba's name. At the peak of the hunt for Oba, a Marine commander devised a plan in which his men would line up across the width of the island, about 2 meters separating one Marine from the next, and they were to march from the south of the island to the north. The commander felt that Oba and his men would have to fight, surrender, or be driven north and eventually be captured due to the dragnet. The elderly and infirm civilians volunteered to surrender. Although some of the soldiers wanted to fight, Oba asserted that their primary concerns were to protect the civilians and to stay alive to continue the war. As the line of Marines approached the area, most of the remaining soldiers and civilians climbed up to a concealed mountain clearing, where others stood on narrow ledges and clung to the side of the mountain. They maintained their precarious positions for most of the day. Marines crossed through the area, and they started, like, basically going through every hut and garden, and they would find them. Like, the Japanese were on the ledges less than 20 feet above the heads of Marines sometimes.
Jeez.
So it's like, literally, I hope he doesn't look up.
Yeah. Oh, and the thing is, they were getting really frustrated because they had no idea. They were like, where the hell are these guys?
And they hear that that's a dog.
Chasing his tail. He's a Great Dane bulldog, so he's, it sounds like a miniature horse. The Marines didn't find him. This eventually led to the commander being reassigned because he was pretty much like they decided he was incompetent.
How hard is it to find people on an island?
Yeah, how hard is it to find people on an island?
It's not even that big of an island.
Yeah, so really funny to think of. And Sophia even asked me earlier to bring this up. So a big part of it, a huge part of the reason a lot of these people refused to surrender. Okay, so there's a lot of reasons. One, a lot of people were terrified because the Japanese Empire weren't the nicest of people with their prisoners.
Unit 741.
And a lot of death marches and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, the pile of human skulls I'm sitting on right now. And most of these are American soldiers, if you noticed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The thing is, though, people would just attack them on sight. And a lot of these islands and stuff. Like, there was an incident in the Philippines where, like, a bunch of Japanese soldiers surrendered and the Philippine citizens just started opening fire on them when they saw them.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, and it was one of those things where it's like, yeah, like, people were not happy with them. So that's why a lot of the civilians were hiding. And the soldiers, there were a couple reasons for the soldiers doing that. One, sense of duty. I mean, as you can see with Captain Oba, he seems like he was actually kind of a good guy because his big thing, like he keeps saying, is we have two duties, to continue fighting the war and protect the civilians. And protecting the civilians is number one.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he seems like he's a decent guy.
Yeah, and the unconditional surrender thing was like a whole, like Japan had built a new religion around their emperor, right?
Okay, they had kind of built it around iconography of the past, more so. It was this thing where, like, the emperor had become a figurehead again.
Mm-hmm.
And they had created a new shogun.
Yeah.
And that's what, what's his name? Something Tojo. Hideki Tojo. So Hideki Tojo basically became, he became the shogun.
Mm.
And they built this entire religion around iconography of the past. The same thing that all fascists did. The way in Italy, it was the Roman Empire. The way in Germany, it was the German Empire. And the way in Japan, it was this new Japanese Empire, even though Japan had never had an empire. The whole thing was the samurai had this whole thing about not surrendering, and the reason being is because the cultural constraints. If I were a samurai and I surrendered, my entire family becomes destitute because of that.
And not just your family, your workers,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, all of my employees.
Peasants,
all,
right?
All of my housekeepers, all of my gardeners, everybody. Gone. So, killing myself is the only way to ensure that my house retains its honor. So, I'm going to do it. So they created this whole religion around, like, that kind of iconography and stuff. Like, the samurai never surrendered and all that. And so there were people like that. But a lot of them were just like, I'm going to do my service. I'm going to do what I have to do. I'm a soldier, damn it. Like, that was a lot of them. A lot of them had realized that they were sent to their death by the Japanese Empire, but yeah, they still felt like they had a duty to their men and stuff like that.
So they didn't know about the surrender, though, right?
Most of them didn't.
Or they didn't believe it.
Yeah, most of them didn't, or they didn't believe it. They thought it was just some American psyop, because
they did that all the time, right? Like, they drop leaflets and...
The U.S. did that all the time, and Japan did stuff like that all the time. I mean, there's that famous person, Tokyo Rose.
She hosted a radio program. She hosted a radio program, basically, during World War II that... would just make, like, really disparaging remarks to the Allied soldiers in English. Like, she'd be speaking English.
And they'd play, like, popular American music for the time.
Yeah, they'd play pop. So the Americans would listen to it. And then she'd come on and be like, you know all your girls are cheating on you back home, right?
Greetings, everybody. This is your number one enemy, your favorite playmate, Orphan Anne of Radio Tokyo. Little sunbeam whose throat you'd like to cut. We're ready again for a vicious assault on your morale. 75 minutes of music and news for our friends, I mean our enemies, in the South Pacific. Well, how are my darling little goats tonight? Full of beer and belligerence? I know, you still hate us, but don't let that hate keep festering. It poisons the whole system. What you need is some good jive. I mean some. Helps you relax. All set? Okay, here's the first blow at your morale. Hey, Kaiser, singing and singing. Hey, Pop, I don't want to go to work. Please be listening.
Oh, yeah, I've seen the pamphlets, too, yeah, where it's like, showing, it's like, yeah, she's going to catch syphilis, and, like, she's going to, all this different...
Yeah, just trying to demoralize.
Like, yeah.
Just trying to demoralize the soldiers and get in their heads, and...
Yeah, so the Japanese just thought that's what this was. Well,
yeah.
Honestly,
they were so far off the grid that nobody knew about them.
Yeah, they were just like, I mean, and that's the thing. Some of them didn't even see the leaflets ever or anything. Some of them just were convinced the war was still going on because nobody had come to relieve them or tell them the war was over.
Oh, yeah, because of all the chaos.
Yeah, because of all
the chaos of losing a world war.
Yeah, I mean, shit, that's a chaotic thing, I'm assuming, to fight in what's known as a world war.
And then so, to be on the losing side of it.
Yeah, to be on the losing side in a place that everybody wants you dead. So Captain Oba and his men held out on the island for 512 days. On the 27th of November 1945, Major General Omahachi Amul, commander of the 9th Independent Mixed Brigade during the Battle of Saipan, was able to draw out some of the Japanese by singing the anthem of the Japanese infantry branch. Amul was then able to present documents from the defunct Imperial General Headquarters to Captain Uoba, ordering him and his 46 remaining men to surrender to the Americans. On December 1st, 1945, 3 months after the official surrender of Japan, the Japanese soldiers gathered once more at Mount Tapuchao and sang a song of departure to the spirits of the war dead. Uoba then led his people out of the jungle. They presented themselves to the Marines of the 18th Anti-Aircraft Artillery Company and were, like, super formal and everything. Uoba surrendered his sword to the Lieutenant Colonel Howard G. Kurgis, and his men surrendered their arms and colors. They were the last organized resistance of Japanese forces on Saipan.
And that was the end of it. There are no more holdouts ever found again.
Well, as our friend Ron Popeil used to say, but wait. There's more. So other than that, we also had Lieutenant E. Yamaguchi and his 33 soldiers emerged on Peleliu in late March 47, attacking the U.S. Marine Corps detachment that was stationed on the island. They believed the war was still being fought. Reinforcements were sent in along with a Japanese admiral who was finally able to convince them to surrender.
Reinforcements by so the
for
official.
For
the Americans.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I was thinking there's like a more Japanese holdouts so or somehow started, communication.
No, they just started fucking those Marines up, apparently.
Yeah, they started like shooting and throwing grenades at these Marines.
They just popped out and started attacking
them. They've been planning this attack for months.
Whoa! This is the moment we feared, people. Many of you thought it would never happen, but I insisted we spend 2 hours every morning training for it. You all thought I was mad. Many of you requested to be transferred to another peanut factory. But now, we...
And they just did it, and like they were able to get reinforcements, and they were like able to convince them to surrender finally, because a Japanese admiral was like, "Stop, stop!" Yeah, like, but that's the thing—they had been planning that attack for months, because like this is late March of 1947, so they had just been watching these Marines.
Yeah, that's like...
since they got to the island, which is probably about a year earlier.
Yeah.
God.
Yeah.
What year are we at?
That was 1947, and that's we're still in the groups.
Mm.
All right. So, 1948, the Associated Press reported that two unnamed Japanese soldiers had surrendered to civilian police in Guam the day before. In 51, June 27th, the Associated Press reported that a Japanese petty officer who surrendered on Atahan Island in the Marinas 2 weeks before said there were about 18 other holdouts there. A U.S. Navy plane that flew over the island spotted 18 Japanese soldiers on a beach waving white flags. The Navy remained cautious as the Japanese petty officer had warned the soldiers were well-armed and that some of them threatened to kill anybody who tried to give himself up. The leaders professed to believe that the war is still on. The Navy dispatched a seagoing tug to the island in the hopes of picking up some or all of the soldiers without incident. After a formal surrender ceremony, all the men were retrieved. And there's that. In 1955, four Japanese airmen surrendered at Hollandia in Dutch New Guinea. Shimada Kaku, Shimokobu Kumo, Ojima Mamoru, and Jigashi Sanzo were the survivors of the bigger group. In 1956, nine soldiers were discovered and sent home from Morotai. In 1956, four men surrendered on the island of Mindoro. Lieutenant Sugichi Yamamoto and the corporals Untaro Ishii, Masajai Izumuda, and Juhei Nakano. And there were alleged sightings in 1981. The Diet of Japan mentioned newspaper reports that holdouts were still in the Solomon Islands. But it's believed these were hoaxes made up to lure Japanese tourists there.
Yeah, because you said they would, like, go looking for them. Like...
Yeah, they would go looking, like, in the Philippines for holdouts and stuff. Like, it became, like, after more publicized events, which we're going to talk about those. But after some more publicized events, like, in the late 70s, early 80s, it became, like, kind of a thing for Japanese tourists to go to the Philippines and stuff, hoping to find holdouts.
Jeez.
Like Bigfoot.
Yeah,
it's literally like trying to find Bigfoot. But
if Bigfoot exists and there's like evidence of Bigfoot,
it might throw a grenade at you, or bayonet you,
or bayonet you, or believe that you're like an American spy, or all sorts of stuff. Even if you do convince them you're Japanese, your clothing might be too Western.
Yeah,
there's a lot of really scary things that could happen with this Bigfoot throwing a grenade at you.
In fact, that seems like a terrible vacation idea.
It really does. Looking at it now, it's like, it's like looking for Bigfoot, but he might bayonet you to death.
Well, I think it's like dark tourism, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like where people go and see, he has a three-syllable name. The guy, the coke dealer of mice, ate his money, and he still had tons.
Jesus Malverde?
No.
Pablo Escobar?
Yeah. Where, like, people go to Pablo Escobar's place where, like, a bunch of people were executed and that kind of shit. It's probably that kind of thing.
Yeah, but imagine you could still be executed by Pablo Escobar right there.
That's part of the draw.
That's part of the draw. With these
people who run the... I don't think it's exactly safe.
Oh, dark tourism is a thing?
Yeah.
But yeah, this just sounds like, this sounds like they thought it was like going to find Bigfoot though. Cause like, I mean, imagine Japanese people in the late '70s, they're probably like, oh yeah, we'll go to the Philippines, go find him. Like going to, you know, going to like,
No. Okay. You want to know what this is like? This is like, hey, I'm going to go look for the Boston Strangler tonight. And you just start walking around Boston in the middle of the night. Yeah. You go yelling, Strangler, here's Strangler, I'm coming for you. Like,
again, also, I don't think the Strangler's as well armed as a Japanese battalion.
Warriors, come out to play. Warriors, come out to play. Warriors. Come out to play. Warriors, come out to play.
No. But that was the first serial killer that came to mind.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I'm just worried that you'd have some guy with dementia.
Yeah.
Especially by, like, the 70s. So, guys, okay, we're going to get to that.
Oh, you know, it also is kind of like, it's like people trying to look for mole people in Las Vegas.
Yeah. Yeah, where it's like...
Okay, that's dangerous.
Yeah, but like this, yeah. It's, it's the same kind of thing.
That is, that's about the level of danger.
Danger that you're doing. Yeah, that is about the same level of danger.
Yeah. So now we're going to get into the notable individuals. And we've got, first up, Yamakage Kufuku and Matsudo Linsoki. They were two Imperial Japanese Navy machine gunners who surrendered on Iwo Jima. The original news article about them didn't correctly report their names. And their real names weren't known until the 60s when they both wrote a book together. The names they were known by in the newspaper were Rikio Matsudo and Kufuku Yamakage. So,
interesting.
Yeah, like, so their real names weren't known until then. And they were captured they surrendered January 6th, 1949. So they were on Iwo Jima for 3 years and 130 days.
Yeah. Jeez. Yeah.
And, like, Iwo Jima, from what I remember, it wasn't, like, it's a volcanic island, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, that would have been horrible.
Is it active?
No, but it's still a volcanic
island. It's all
so
rocky,
like,
and sand.
Like,
I go to sand.
Grows there.
Yeah, like, they were...
they were eating, like, seabirds for 3 years.
Yeah, it was just fresh land.
Yeah, they were, like, eating, like, fish and crabs and seagulls and stuff for, like, 3 years.
People gotta eat. We're gonna sell these on the street. We're crab people now.
We're crab people now?
Yes.
You want us to become crab people? That's your new business plan?
Yeah.
Okay, so it is pretty green, actually.
Okay, so there is some greenery on it. Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty green, actually. But...
there's a lot of not...
Like, you should look at the Wikipedia to see, like, what... Yeah, it doesn't look like there's really much there, actually. So we should probably look at the Wikipedia to see, like, what they actually have. Yeah, right. It's Sulfur Island. That's literally what it means. Sulfur Island.
Apparently now it's called Iyoto.
Yeah, Iyoto. Okay.
Oh.
Sulfur Island.
Yeah. But
it's still emits sulfurous gases.
Oh my God. So yeah, this place would have been miserable.
There's like an airstrip and grass.
And that's it. That's like all there is like an airstrip, like, and grass.
That's like, I remember that being like a thing about World War II, like in the Pacific, is that Iwo Jima was particularly bad.
Yeah, and it was one of those things where that was the...
Wait, what was the... Go back up. That's the temperatures?
Oh yeah, this is not too bad. It's pretty... It stays between the highest it gets is 86 and the lowest it gets
Look at precipitation though.
Oh yeah, precipitation. Oh yeah.
My God.
So yeah, the average precipitation from April through the end of the year to December is all 99 or greater millimeters per year, or 3.9 inches. Just precipitation, not per year. Just yeah.
Per month.
Yeah, 99 millimeters per month, or 3.9 inches per month. The peak is in July with 7.1 inches of rain, which distributed over 28 days would be a quarter inch per day. So a little less than a quarter inch per day. So, you know, it's just constantly drizzling.
Yeah, it's just constantly raining on this volcanic island with nothing on it.
One day, it started raining, and it didn't quit for 4 months.
And apparently there's nukes on it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah, now, but back then, they
no,
didn't
no,
even
now
have,
they're
they didn't even have nuclear bombs to eat.
Yeah. I know. Yeah,
so they were like eating seagulls and like crabs and stuff. Like,
we'll live and die by the crab, D. We'll eat off the fat of the sea.
Okay, so now
I like how it says Pooh's probably visited or inhabited, but like,
yeah, it's like, yeah,
it's like maybe what were people doing here, kind of thing.
What are people doing here?
They're just tagging the island, which is an awesome human tradition.
Yeah. All right, so.
They're probably leaving warning saying, don't come here.
Don't live here. We tried. It doesn't work. Okay, so yeah, now we're at Yuichi Akasu, who in March of 1950 was, that's how long he lasted. 4 years, 210 days. Lubang, Philippines. He was a private first class, and he continued to fight on Lubang Island from 44 until surrendering in the village of Lok in March of 1950.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So that's 6 years, right?
4 years, 210 days.
Well, that was, how, it, it's, oh, yeah, the war ended 45, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, officially ended. Yeah, it officially ended, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we got Marita Susumu, who was found 1953, so 8 years, 120 days. Tinayan Mariana Islands, that's where he was found. So Marita Sumusu was the last holdout on Tinan and was captured in 1953. That's all it really says about him.
Yeah.
And then Soichi Shimada, May of 54, 8 years, 271 days, Lubang, Philippines. Corporal Soichi Shimada was holding out with Lieutenant Unada, which we'll get into in a little bit. And, yeah, he's definitely a very fascinating character.
Yeah, Unada is interesting.
Yeah, he's very fascinating. But so he's holding out with Unada, and he continued to fight on Lubang until he was killed in a clash with Philippine soldiers in May of 54. So he was killed. That guy. So this Japanese soldier, after like 8 years after the war, just started firing at Philippine soldiers and they killed him. And jeez, they were like, what the crap? And this is almost 10 years after the war's ended.
So that probably really freaked them out.
Yeah. Because again, 8 years, 271 days after the war officially ended.
God.
So now we're at Noboru Kinoshita, which November 1955, 10 years, 89 days. Luzon, Philippines. In November 1955, Seaman Noboru Kinoshita was captured in the Luzon jungle, but shortly afterward committed suicide by hanging himself rather than return to Japan defeated.
So
he was nuts. He was insane. He was just going to keep fighting even though he probably knew the war was over.
Yeah.
Now we're at Bunzo Minagawa, which May of 1960. 14 years, 261 days, Guam.
So he outlasted the Beatles.
Yeah, he outlasted the Beatles.
He also outlasted the time between Daft Punk last album and their retirement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a dig at Nurse.
Oh, I know. That's a dig at Daft Punk. Yeah. Private Bunzo Minagawa held out until, on Guam, which... Unfortunately, there's nothing about him on here, so I'm assuming he probably just got tired. He was probably like, I'm just done. I'm so done with this shit, and just gave up. Cause...
Is anybody even looking for it? He must have felt like the last kid in hide and seek. Is anybody even looking for me?
Yeah, is anybody looking for me? Like, yeah. Yeah, he's probably also just sick of living in the jungle. He's like, I want to go sleep in a bed again.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's the thing. Apparently, certain things will just set you off. Like, you'll just think of a bed or something. And, like, that, like, when people are doing things like this, that's what will set them off.
They're just like, nope, I'm done. I'm going back.
Yeah, like, fugitives and stuff, apparently, like, that, like, hide out in a swamp or something forever. They'll just think of a bed and they'll be like, okay, I'm done. I'm done. I want a bed. Yeah. Masashi Ito was a machine gunner, a sergeant in the Imperial Japanese Army during the Second World War, and he was one of the last holdouts. When the Americans liberated Guam in July, Ito was separated from his unit, and he hid with two other soldiers and learned to survive in the jungle. For 16 years, he hid, even after finding leaflets declaring the war had ended. When the last of his companions, Bunzo Minagawa, was captured by woodsmen. Okay, so that's what happened to Bunzo, is he was captured by woodsmen.
He probably tried to rob them or attack them, and they subdued him.
Well, he should have hid out in the cottage with the seven dwarves.
After that happened, Ito was convinced to surrender in May of 1960, and he just went to an American military base where they gave him medical treatment, because they were probably like, my God.
You've been out there for how long?
Yeah, so that's what happened to... Okay, so now we know what happened to Bunzo. He tried robbing them and got, like, arrested.
Yeah, he probably, like, tried robbing them.
All right, so that's Musashi Ito. And, all right, now we have Soichi Yokoi, which Soichi Yokoi was a sergeant in the Imperial Japanese Army. During the Second World War, he was one of the last three holdouts to be found at the end of hostilities. He was discovered in the jungles of Guam on the 24th of January, 1972, almost 28 years after the U.S. forces had regained control of the island.
Oh, dear Lord.
Yeah. Yeah, so he was, during the Battle of Guam, he went into hiding with nine other Japanese soldiers. Seven of the 10 originally moved away, and the only three remained in the region. The men separated but would visit each other periodically until about 64 when the other two died in a flood. For the last 8 years, Yokoi lived alone. He was survived by hunting primarily at night. He also used native plants to make clothing, bedding, and storage implements.
So he became feral.
He basically was like George of the Jungle out there, like making his own clothing and stuff.
Like he almost became a feral person.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, you know how he was captured, right?
Yes, I do, actually.
Okay, yeah, because you didn't bring that up on how he was captured.
Not yet. Not yet. So, on the evening of the 24th of January, 1972, Yokoi was discovered by two local men checking shrimp traps along a small river. They had assumed Yokoi was a villager, but he thought his life was in danger and attacked them. Nope. They managed to subdue him and carried him out of the jungle.
These two guys, like, walked up. They saw this guy covered in, like, leaves and moths and shit like that. Checking fish, like, shrimp traps. And they're like, hey, you catch anything good? And he's like, they're trying to kill me.
Starts screaming at him and charging them.
How many hats do you think he had?
At least three.
Yeah, I think so. Like, probably had a dirt hat and, like, a grass hat and, like, a flower hat.
Yeah, so, like...
For hiding.
Yeah, well, yeah. Because he was making camouflage this entire time, too.
The dedication.
Yeah, like, he was camouflaging himself to the environment for 28 years.
Yeah, so...
So he probably got really fucking good at it.
Also, completely insane.
Yes.
So Yokoi later said that he expected the local men to kill him, but was surprised when instead they allowed him to eat soup at their home before turning him over to the authorities. He was in relatively good health, but anemic due to lack of salt in his diet, according to doctors. His diet included wild nuts, mangoes, papayas, shrimp, snails, frogs, and rats.
Oh, wow.
So he actually had a pretty good diet out there.
It was actually varied.
Why didn't he die of... Probably couldn't swim
very well.
Yeah, and probably couldn't.
It's interesting fact, most swimming techniques were invented on, I believe, the East Coast by the Native Americans.
Mm-hmm. And it is with much embarrassment that I return, he said, upon his return to Japan in March of 72. The remark quickly became a popular saying in Japan. He had known since 1952 that the war had ended, but feared coming out of hiding, explaining... We Japanese soldiers were told to prefer death. And he was one of the last three holdout soldiers discovered.
I think that's why some of those dudes, like, just started randomly attacking groups of, like, soldiers and shit, is that, at least this way I don't surrender. Like, I'd rather die and have it end that way than me surrender and have it end.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, afterward, he became a little bit of, like, a celebrity.
Which he didn't want.
Yeah, and, like, he became a popular... Actually, he did kind of want it.
Okay.
Because he became an advocate of simple living. And he basically taught people that, like...
I lived on snails for 30 years. You can do it, too.
If you leave the shells out, you get rats.
He received $300 in back pay.
What year?
Service.
What year is this?
1972.
Was Japan going through...
No, their economy was on the uptick.
It was doing good in 72?
Yeah, it was actually doing pretty good.
Okay, so they just kind of fucked him then.
Yes. Yes, of course they did. You're going to see that's kind of a pattern in this episode, Jacob.
Yeah, a couple grand. Yeah, two grand.
They gave him like $2,000.
Yeah, the equivalent in the U.S. would be about the equivalent today
would be about $2,000 is what they gave him.
Yeah.
I could see how many yen it would be today if you want.
Nah, okay.
We're fine. Now we're getting to the last three holdouts.
Number three.
Yeah. So now we have Kinshichi Kozuka, who was discovered in October of 72. So about 9 months later.
God. Mm-hmm.
27 years, 59 days in the Philippines. So... back to the Philippines. Because, yeah, we were in Guam with the guy that was eating the nuts and berries and stuff.
I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, it seems like a long way to go for such an easy conclusion. Of course, you've also ingested enough poisonous berries to kill a small elephant.
Okay, so in October 1972, Private First Class Kinshichi Kozuka, who had held out with Hiro Onada, was killed in a shootout with the Philippine police. So, but yeah, he was killed in a shootout with the Philippine police. And I mean, this is 1972. So this is like some comic book crap at that point.
Yeah.
I mean, you have like these former soldiers all like, fighting cops.
No, it must have been like
just complete madness for them.
Yeah.
All right. So now we're finally at Lieutenant Hiro Onoda. And, okay, he spent 29 years hiding out in the Philippines.
And he was the victor, right? I mean, in this weird contest?
No. No. We got a victor.
Oh, he's number two, right?
He is number two. He is the second to last to be found. So, Onoda, he knew the war, like that. There had been the leaflets and stuff, and that like a bunch of Japanese forces were withdrawing, and he thought they were all stupid and they'd all fallen for a trick. He continued his campaign, living in the mountains of Lubang Island in the Philippines. Let me give you a little bit of background on his military career. Onoda trained as an intelligence officer, Futamata, which is a commando class, and he was sent to Lubang Island in the Philippines, and he was ordered to do all he could to hamper enemy attacks on the island, including destroying the airstrip and the pier at the harbor. His orders also stated that under no circumstances was he allowed to surrender or take his own life. Okay, so, like...
Oh!
Yeah, so he knew the war was over, but he was ordered not to surrender or take his own life.
So that leaves one option. Continue the war.
Yeah. So,
Sophia, it leaves him one option. He has to continue the war till they kill him.
Yeah,
God, this is, it's like, this is the self-referent, anyway.
Yeah. So he landed on the island. He joined the forces of a group of Japanese soldiers who had been sent there previously. The officers in the group outranked him and prevented him from carrying out his assignment, which made it easier for the United States and the Philippine Commonwealth forces to take the island when they landed. So they kept telling him, you're going to die. You're going to get yourself killed if you go out there, and kept telling him it was the dumbest thing he could do. And they were like, we outrank you, so we're not going to let you go die.
But this is what I've been training for.
Yeah, so yeah, when they took the island within a short time of landing, all of him, like, but him and three other soldiers had either died or surrendered. Onoda had now been promoted to lieutenant and ordered his men to take to the hills. And yeah, so Onoda continued his campaign, initially living in the mountains of Lubang Island in the Philippines, with three fellow soldiers. Private Yuichi Katsu, who, as we remember, is the guy that got killed by the Philippine police.
Oh, yeah.
Corporal Soichi Shimada and Private First Class Kinsichi Kozuka. During his stay, Unoda and his companions carried out guerrilla activities and engaged in several shootouts with the local police. Unoda, along with his fellow soldiers, allegedly killed up to 30 Filipino civilians over the three decades during after World War II. The first time he saw a leaflet announcing that Japan had surrendered was October of 45. Another cell had killed a cow and found a leaflet left behind by islanders which read, "The war ended on the 15th August. Come down from the mountains." However, they distrusted the leaflet, and they concluded it was propaganda.
God.
They also believed that they would not have been fired on if the war had indeed been over.
Well, as we explained before...
Yeah, with that crazy guy, right? I tell the truth
half
the time.
No, that group that tried to surrender and those fishermen just started firing at them
because it was like, that was the guys.
Those are the ones that did it.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, it reminds me a little bit, too, of... remember, who was that guy, the radio personality who influenced a lot of hip-hop?
Rose?
No, who influenced a lot of hip-hop a lot later than the... he got killed in a shootout with the police because they were dressed like civilians.
Oh, Bill Cooper.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Bill Cooper, where he's like, well, of course I thought people were like, and then he died in a blaze of glory anyway.
Yeah. Oh,
not
yeah.
a glory. I'm not glorifying this man.
Well, again, they just like got shot at, like they saw a bunch of soldiers get shot at on the Philippine Islands for surrendering. And we're like, okay, the war's definitely not over. So they were like, no, there's no way. And, toward the end of 45, leaflets were dropped by air with the surrender order printed on them from General Tomoyuki Yamashita of the 14th Area Army to the men who had been in hiding for over 6 months. The leaflet was the only evidence they had the war was actually over. Unoda's group studied the leaflet closely to determine whether or not it was genuine and decided it wasn't. Decided it was a forgery. So, one of the other four soldiers, Yuichi Akatsu, walked away from the others in 1949 and surrendered to Philippine forces in 50, which we talked about him earlier, after 6 months on his own. This seemed like a security problem to the others, and they became even more cautious, so more paranoid.
Yeah, they went crazy.
In 52, letters and family pictures were dropped from an aircraft urging them to surrender. So, like, they were really trying to get these guys out.
Yeah.
They knew they were there.
They kidnapped our families and the.
Yeah, they knew the general area that these guys were keeping to, but they couldn't find them.
Now you're getting their thinking. Letters and family pictures were dropped from an aircraft urging them to surrender, but the soldiers concluded it was a trick. Shimada was wounded in the leg in a shootout with local fishermen in June of 53. After which, Unoda nursed him back to health. On the 7th of May, 1954, Shimada was killed by a shot from a search party looking for the men. Kazuka was killed by two shots fired by local police on the 19th of October, 72. While he and Unoda, as part of a guerrilla, as part of their guerrilla activities, were burning rice that had been collected by the farmers. Unoda was alone at that point. So they were just lighting rice on fire, and the police shot at them and killed them.
Yeah.
Yeah, they found like a store, like a grain warehouse for it or something.
A
like
granary?
That. Yeah, like a granary for rice. Yeah. And then they lit it on fire. And the police started shooting at them for that.
Okay.
What do you think an average day was like?
For these guys?
Do you think they talked while they ate meals?
No, actually. I think they actually spend a lot of their time in silence with each other.
Okay, so...
Just because that's weirder.
Yeah, it is.
On the 20th of February, 74, Unoda met Norio Suzuki, who... We could honestly do an entire episode about Norio Suzuki, because he was insane.
Oh.
Like...
I'm down. Well, that might get... Yeah.
He was traveling around the world looking for Lieutenant Unoda, a panda, and the abominable snowman in that order.
But wait. Say that word like a penguin, a panda, and a...
Lieutenant Onoda, a panda, and the Abominable Snowman, in that order. Oh. He was traveling around the world to see those three things specifically. N-O-R-I-O-S-U-Z-U-K-I.
Okay, that's what I thought, but I wasn't sure.
Norio Suzuki. Which, he was also killed looking for the Abominable Snowman.
Nice.
By an Abominable Snowman.
By an Abominable Snow Avalanche.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe it was a polar bear. But no, Avalanche.
That would have been cool, though. I found the snowman. And again, he was looking for them in that order, which is also just insane.
Crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Why do you need the order? Like,
well, thank God he started with that, because actually,
if
he started...
panda would have been the easiest.
I think a panda would have been the easiest, too.
They go to the zoo.
Because also, panda, you don't have a chance of a panda throwing a grenade at you.
Yes. Again, you don't have a chance of Bigfoot throwing a grenade at you. And Bigfoot isn't real.
Yeah. Suzuki found Onoda after 4 days of searching. Onoda described the moment in 2010. This hippie boy, Suzuki, came to the island to listen to the feelings of a Japanese soldier. Suzuki asked me why I would not come out. Onoda and Suzuki became friends, but Onoda still refused to surrender, saying that he was waiting for orders from a superior.
So he's E.T. now.
Yeah.
Kinda. Yeah.
Kinda.
Yeah, he befriended him like E.T.
E.T. might even the odds.
He who giveth life can also take it away.
And,
ouch.
And he was like, I will not leave until a superior tells me to. I would have just been like,
I'm your superior.
I've been like, okay, I'll be right back. Yeah. He kind of had the same idea I did. He was waiting for the orders. Suzuki returned to Japan with photographs of himself and Onoda as proof of their encounter. And the Japanese government located his commanding officer, Major Yoshimi Taniguchi, who had long surrendered and become a bookseller. Taniguchi went to Lubang Island on the 9th of March, 74, where he met with Onoda and fulfilled a promise he had made back in 44. Whatever happens, we'll come back for you.
God.
Taniguchi then issued the following orders. In accordance with the Imperial Command, the 14th Area Army has ceased all combat activity. In accordance with the Military Headquarters Command, number A-2003, the Special Squadron of Staff's headquarters is relieved of all military duties. And number three, units and individuals under the command of the Special Squadron are to cease military activities and operations immediately and place themselves under the command of the nearest superior officer. When no officer can be found, they are to communicate with the American or Philippine forces and follow their directions.
This is like writing a program. Like this, it just reminds me of like when they flashed patterns at the Borg to confuse them.
Yeah. Okay, so Onoda was thus properly relieved of duty, and he surrendered. He turned over his sword, a functioning Ariska Type 99 rifle, 500 rounds of ammunition, several hand grenades, and a dagger that his mother had given him in 1944 to kill himself with if he was captured. Only Private Teru Nakamura, arrested on the 18th of December, held out longer, which... Now to get to our friend, Teru Nakamura.
I find it pretty interesting that he still had 500 rounds of ammo left after 28 years.
I know. I think he was waiting for an opportunity, and like maybe he wasn't given a fire order. I don't know.
I just find that interesting.
Yeah, I found it very interesting, too. I was like,
using it for hunting, at least, even? Like,
yeah.
He had all the rounds of his, I'm sure he had the rounds of all of his dead comrades and stuff like that. And also, he knew the location of, like, Japanese bunkers all over the island and stuff.
Oh, probably. Yeah, makes sense.
So, I mean,
something
like that.
He may have been resupplying.
Because, I mean, that's the thing, like. A Type 99 rifle, that would have been one of those things that nobody else would have had any use for on the island.
Yeah.
So the guy also, apparently in TV interviews later on, in a 2004 issue of Gekken Hiden, he apparently started making claims that he could, like, dodge bullets, and he had learned to do that during the war.
Oh, yeah. And one thing that I found really, like, I think it explains the spirit of this guy, this weird, crazy spirit, is the moment, he said, the moment I desperately felt that I had to risk my life, I felt my head swell to several times its size, and at the same time I was attacked by a chill and shivered. It is said that it became possible to see brightly and clearly. Even though dusk was approaching, it was as bright as daytime. I could see the movements of the enemy soldiers in the room. That's why I think I could dodge bullets just before the enemy fires. It was the moment when he became confident that he would be okay without gambling, according to him.
Yeah, so he went insane. Like, it turns out being out in the jungle that long just melted his brain.
Oh, this other thing I thought was interesting. They took a bath together, and then he started explaining how to shoot a gun while saying things like, young people are no good these days.
Ooh, well.
I love it.
And now we're going to talk about Teru Nakamura, who was born Atun Palalin, and he was also known as Sunio.
How come his name changed?
That's what I'm going to get to. He was a Taiwanese-Japanese soldier of the Imperial Japanese Army who fought for Japan in World War II and did not surrender. But he was of Aboriginal descent, and he was born in Taiwan.
Gotcha. So would he have been, what's the name of the Japanese natives?
The Ainu?
Would he have been Ainu?
That's a very good question.
It says Aboriginal.
It says Taiwan, too, so I don't know if
yeah, exactly. Like, I don't know if that means Aboriginal to Japan, or...
Damn it, okay. We should have researched this.
Okay, here we go. The Formosian, the Austronesian, Taiwanese.
Austronesian, yeah.
Yeah. The Yanzhu Heman, the Gaoshan, and formerly are known as Taiwanese Aborigines. And he was a member of the Takasago Volunteers, which the Takasago Volunteers were, they were literally just a unit of people conscripted from the Aborigines.
Yeah.
So he fought in the Imperial Japanese Army, and he was stationed at Morotai Island in the Dutch East Indies. And it was like right before the island fell. He was declared dead on November 13, 1944 by the Japanese Army. After the Allies captured the island, it appears Nakamura remained there with three other stragglers well into the 50s through setting off for extended periods of his own. In 1956, he relinquished his allegiance with his fellow holdouts and set off to construct a solitary camp consisting of a small hut. So he basically like just started having like a bunch of disagreements with them in 56 and was like, screw you guys, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
Live with you guys long enough.
His hut was discovered in November of 1974, and the Japanese embassy in Jakarta requested assistance from the Indonesian government in organizing a search mission, which was conducted by the Indonesian Air Force, leading to Nakamura's arrest by Indonesian soldiers on the 18th of December, 1974. He was flown to Jakarta, and he was hospitalized. News of his discovery reached Japan on the 27th, and Nakamura decided to be repatriated straight to Taiwan. Bypassing Japan.
Bart, Barty, calm down. That's the dog. Bart, sit down. Good boy.
News of his discovery reached Japan on the 27th. Nakamura decided to be repatriated straight to Taiwan, bypassing Japan. Upon his return, the Taiwanese press referred to him as Li Kuang-yi, a name he learned of only after his repatriation. Initially, the Republic of China government on Taiwan did not receive him well, seeing him as a Japanese loyalist. At the time, the Japanese public's perceptions of Nakamura and his repatriation differed considerably from those of earlier holdouts such as Hiro Unada, who had been discovered only a few months earlier and was both an officer and ethnically Japanese. As a private in a colonial unit on foreign soil, Nakamura was not entitled to a pension due to a 1953 change in the law of pensions, and he received the sum of 68,000 yen, $227.59 at the time, about $1,400 by today's standard.
Jeez. So less than the other guy.
Yep. This caused a considerable outcry of press, motivating the Republic of China government to public and the public to donate a total of 4,250,000 yen to Nakamura, a total of 84,000 in today's terms.
Well,
5 years after his repatriation, he died of lung cancer.
Well, he got to go home
for 5 years and fight them every step of the way.
Yeah, I'm trying to put a happy spin on it because, God, they fucked him like the worst.
Yeah, well.
So it kind of reminds me of, like, if, like, let's say, like, the Axis forces had somehow succeeded and, like, there's a code talker who was, like, trapped somewhere or something. I'm trying to think of an example that would, like, because it sounds like he was kind of like the code talkers where they recruited from a native group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically. And, yeah, and then the Japanese were like, I mean, imagine America, like, fell to the Axis powers, but even more so, it'd be like us taking somebody from Guam and like forcing them to fight and stuff like
that. Yeah, it's hard to find a parallel.
It's hard to find a parallel. Yeah,
contextualization.
In the end, the poor guy got screwed.
He really absolutely
got screwed. I mean, he held out longer than any other soldier, and they thanked him by giving him like $1,200.
God.
And remember, that's the lesson here. You can be as loyal as you want to your country, and they can give you $1,200 to thank you.
Yep.
Bonus round.
Dun, 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 dun.
Fumio Nakahara. This is the guy that they looked for in January of 1980.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about him.
So, the Asahi Shimbun reported in January 1980 that Captain Fumio Nakahara was still holding out on Mount Halcon? On Mount Halcon in the Philippines. A search team headed by his former comrade in arms, Iseo Miyazawa, believed they had found his hut. Miyazawa had been looking for Nakahara for many years. However, no evidence that Nakahara was still alive at the time had been found. So there was one guy that they think they had evidence that he was out there, they think, but they just never found his body.
So possibly just even like fell in the ocean or something, because at that point he would have been incredibly old.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The last report that was taken seriously by the Japanese officials took place in May of 2005, when two elderly men emerged from the jungle in the Philippines claiming to be ex-soldiers. It was initially assumed that the media attention scared the two men off as they disappeared and were not heard from again. Suspicions of a hoax or a kidnapping attempt later mounted, as the area where the alleged soldiers emerged from is notorious for ransom kidnappings and attacks by Muslim separatists.
Yeah, it's like where Abu Sayyaf operates and stuff.
It is unknown how many or if any legitimate Japanese holdouts remain today. The National World War II Museum reported in 2022 that surviving veterans are dying quickly, as those who served are now in their 90s or older.
God.
So yeah, there's no more World War II veterans alive, pretty much, that like that could be in the jungles.
No, at this point, they would be too enfeebled.
Unless they found like the Gem of Sidorak or like the sacred flower or something.
Yeah,
like,
you know, they're eating royal jelly and it's turning them into
some sort of bee monster or something. Like, it's the only way they could really live. So with that, like I said, we're going to close out and let y'all know that you can always reach us on our Facebook. You can also email us at nerdforensics@gmail.com.
And if we made any mistakes, please let us know and we'll publish errata.
And just to let y'all know, don't fight for an army for more years than you need to, because they'll just give you $1,200 and tell you to fuck yourself. Good night.